welcome back to Franklin Covey's twice weekly podcast on Leadership with Scott Miller. That's me. I'm your host each week, where on Tuesdays and Fridays, we shine Franklin Covey's spotlight globally onto different thought leaders. Franklin Covey, of course, the most trusted leadership firm in the world. Many of you have read our books, you've attended our work sessions, and many companies have our all-access pass infused throughout your culture, all designed to help build better leaders and create cultures where people choose to stay and choose to stay engaged. Our guest today is Melina Palmer. Melina is the host of the Brainy Business Podcast. She is a renowned behavioral economist. We'll learn more about what that is. And the author of a series of books, the most recent of which we are focusing on today, titled The Truth About Pricing: How to Apply Behavioral Economics So Customers Buy. Who doesn't want to learn more about that? So if you are in any way involved in how pricing is set for your products, your services, your content, your value proposition, whether you're in operations or marketing or thought leadership or product development or sales, oh wait, we're all involved in sales. This is going to be a great conversation for you. Melina Palmer, welcome to On Leadership.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Melina, you and I have known each other for several years. I've been a follower, listener, subscriber to your podcast. You have very graciously invited me to be a guest on some occasions, and I've read your books and been a fan of your writings, but I'm still not sure I really know what a behavioral economist is. You've tried to teach me on several occasions, but will you reintroduce yourself to our listeners and viewers around the world and re-educate everybody? What do you do and why is it so important?
Absolutely, and thank you so much for having me. It's a joy to be here on the show. In the space of behavioral economics, and I'm in that applied side, so actually using the information versus being like academic research, it's really in understanding human behavior, why people do the things they do, why they buy the things they buy. And yes, that's on the customer-facing side, like we said in The Truth About Pricing, but it's also in what gets employees to buy in, understanding how the brain really works and being able to better communicate. As you know, we're all human, we all have brains, and things would go a lot better if we're able to understand how people really make decisions instead of how we think that they should, so that we can communicate in a way that makes it so people are naturally more likely to want to work with and for us and buy our products and services that are going to help them in a positive way. So that's the really short answer, I guess, to what behavioral economics is and kind of why I think the field is important.
Melina, I'm going to ask you to pull some insights out of your first two books, and then we'll get a little deeper into your current, most recent release, The Truth About Pricing. But first, how did you explore this journey? What was it that interested and fascinated you to really dedicate your expertise? I mean, you are the essence of a flywheel, as Jim Collins calls it, this concept, true or not, around 10,000 hours. You have more like, you know, a couple hundred thousand hours. Why have you put the full force of your writing, your teaching, your podcasting, your consulting, your keynoting, your coaching around this topic? Why do you find it so interesting?
I love the question. Thank you. I would say that, so in the beginning of time, you know, I was looking at potentially getting into some area of psychology when I decided I didn't want to be a professional singer. But that's why I do a podcast and things like that these days, right? Be up on the stage, do the keynotes and things. In the case of, I was getting a degree in marketing, and I was reading, there was like this one book that had this section about psychology of buying decisions, why people do the things they do. And it just fascinated me. And I would say I've always been a really curious person, been interested in, you know, why someone said something that way, or how you can be persuasive when having a conversation, and how to naturally make it so people want to engage and continue talking with you, and wondering why, you know, in this case, something worked and something we thought should have been perfect was a big flop, or if something took off that we weren't expecting, you know, why did that happen? And not just sitting in this space of believing that I'm always right, you know, and whatever that happens to be. And so in the space of finding behavioral economics and the greater behavioral sciences, seeing that it's not just that there's an art to it. So I know that we both, you know, we have that background and kind of a root in that marketing space. And marketing kind of gets written off as being fluffy to a lot of people, right? That there's not a science behind it. And you get into a lot of like going with your gut, which for some people can really get you in the right path, then it works for you for a really long time. And sometimes it takes people down the wrong path. And where people have said forever, you just, if we knew if there was a science to it or something, then that would be great. But there isn't anything. We just have to go with what we believe is going to work. And finding in the greater behavioral sciences and in behavioral economics that really, when we understand how the brain makes decisions, when we can unlock the rules that it's using, it can be very, very predictable. And we can see how a tiny shift, just one word here or there, can have a tremendous impact on what someone chooses to do. And I find that to be so fascinating. And then in being able to help people to then apply that in a way that they can have this immediate and tremendous uplift in the work that they're doing, in the conversions that they're getting, whether that's not getting ghosted on an email internally or getting buy-in on their project, or it has to do with, again, getting customers, you know, a huge response to an ad that has been pretty like stagnant for a long time. It's just a really amazing thing to see, and to be able to share those lessons again and again for people in a way that they're able to go implement is something that I can't help but keep finding all the new things about how our brains work so that I can share it with the rest of the world.
Melina, let's build on that and let's water ski across your first two books and then dive a little deeper into your pricing book. I believe your first book was What Your Customer Wants and Can't Tell You. Give us a few golden nuggets from that book so that people can decide if that's a great first place to start. What Your Customer Wants and Can't Tell You.
Absolutely. So this book is really the more of an introduction into what behavioral economics is, how our brains really work, and a deep dive on some of these concepts as you want to try to apply them. So knowing that our brains are, we humans make an average of 35,000 decisions every single day. And so knowing that the bulk of those are done on a subconscious level, right? You don't remember making 35,000 decisions yesterday. And so if we think about the decisions that you can remember, it's hard to when we focus on those. So using these rules to be able to know how you can start to apply things like concept of framing, that how we say something matters more than what we say. One of my favorite examples here being like you go to the grocery store, you see two stacks, you're going to get some, we'll say hamburger, you have to go. And there are two stacks almost identical. And you're trying to decide which one you want. The only difference between them is that one is labeled as 90% fat-free, the other as 10% fat. So which one do you want to buy? And most people around the world, when I've given this example, and others have done similar, everybody says 90% fat-free is the one that we want, right? Logically, we know they're the same, but they feel completely different in the way that they're presented. So what's really empowering in this is to know that if something's not taking off, it's not necessarily that the product is wrong or the price is wrong, which I know we'll get to, but it might just be that you're talking about it in 10% fat terms. And if you were to reframe that and be able to communicate as 90% fat free, someone might be overjoyed to buy in. They just didn't realize that it was a fit for them. And again, that's not a change that has to cost a bunch of money. You can just tweak the way you're talking about it, find that reframe that's going to be compelling, and it's going to encourage people to be excited to buy.
Is there something in particular that customers want but can't tell you that you might surface to the top?
I think it's the key point with this being that because our brain is in these two systems, they don't actually speak very well to one another. So we don't realize why we're buying things. So, and if we ask someone, you know, you do a focus group or a survey and you say, hey, we're going to do this toothpaste. It's going to have baking soda in it. Would that make you want to buy it? And they say, oh yeah, absolutely. I would buy that. They don't really know. And it's not that they're lying to you on purpose, but they don't understand how the brain is really making a buying decision. And research has showed, you know, you put someone in an fMRI machine, the brain like lights up as if it's lying to itself when you see it trying to answer a question like that. And so when you ask somebody, would you buy this? Would you be upset if we did this? The things they say are often not right, not because they are, again, lying, but they don't really know what they would do in that moment. And what behavioral economics does, and in What Your Customer Wants and Can't Tell You, I give you 16 key concepts from the hundreds, you know, that exist, to be able to start and have a toolkit to begin to apply it yourself. And so understanding those, and there's a recipe to follow. I have a framework called behavioral baking as you go in to start applying these concepts into your work and really using it. But knowing that these types of concepts, like humans are loss averse, right? We don't like to give things up. And so what someone may tell you is that they would hate if you had a message that said that something was going away and that you better not do that because I'm not going to buy from you anymore and I'm going to be really mad. And then if you test it, the thing that's the most compelling that most people end up clicking on that gets them to buy is often something that has that loss aversion messaging, because we have FOMO, right? We don't want to miss out on the thing that's there. So it motivates behavior in a way that when we sit and think about it on this logical, conscious level, we would say, I hate that. I wouldn't want it, right? That wouldn't work for me. But when push comes to shove, when the moment actually is upon us, it impacts behavior in a different way. So this is why understanding the rules and then having a really good setup of using it as a lens so you can be continually testing this type of work is impactful in being able to have more value to your business.
Well, you see this play out in almost every celebrity cosmetic launch, right? Is that it sold out in the first hour, and all you know is they may have sold 12 lipsticks or 12 million, but they scarcity, you know, forced it into small amounts so that it would, you know, sell out immediately. And then, of course, there'll be more next week. To our listeners and viewers, On Leadership, this podcast is not a book review podcast, right? We don't only interview authors. When we do, frequently a lot of our guests are authors. I rarely walk you through the history of their books. But in this case today, Melina has, I think, these books that really nicely build on each other as part of a series. And so I want to take a little deeper dive now into your next book, and then we'll talk about the pricing book. Your second book, I believe, was called What Your Employees Need and Can't Tell You. Give us a short ID on that. Share one thing maybe that employees can't tell us, and then we'll go deep into in pricing.
For sure. This book is, yes, the second one, and it is looking at how our brains really react to change and how we can be more impactful as a leader inside of an organization. So if you're wanting to encourage people to buy in on an idea, trying to get budget, trying to get a new team member, you're trying to get a project off of the ground, often you're trying to influence people that don't report to you, which can be really difficult. But if you have it may feel like you just need to be charismatic. And if you don't have that natural tendency, you have no hope in getting people to buy in on your ideas. You're just sort of stuck and it's an uphill battle forever. But really, if you understand how change works and the way that we communicate the message can make it so it's easier for people to naturally buy in on whatever idea it is that you're selling them. And so in this book, I talk about how change really works. And I talk about how you can present information to make it so people are more likely to want to buy in on those ideas. And I would say that some of the key stuff here, it's all, you know, intertwined again, that we don't know how we would react and what we think we want would be isn't something we can necessarily explain properly and how we're actually going to act in the moment. In the case of leadership, management, working with teams, interpersonal communication, we have a lot of times where people will say, oh, people know what I mean. They know I'm a good person. They know I have good intentions. I'm just busy, but they get it. Right? They should know. They should understand the logic behind this decision. They should be making all these complex calculations. They should just get it. And if they don't, kind of that's on them to figure out. It's not about me. And what this book really shows is how, whether we would like it to be that way or not, our brains have a lot of immediate responses in the way that we look at information, how it's presented to us, that absolutely impacts how we feel about people, their ideas, and whether we want to buy in on them or not. And so if you can make a couple of small tweaks, if there are a few moments where you can be more thoughtful in the way that you present your information, it can make all the difference. So I give an example, one in the book, of a previous boss, and I had been at this company for just under, it was under 90 days. So I was still in that very key window of, you know, probation and things. And I got an email from this boss at 10 a.m. on a Thursday that said, we need to talk, be in my office at 2. And that is a terrifying email to get. It is really scary. And of course, I spent the next 4 hours looking at every project I had been working on, every person I was talking to, anything and everything, you know, binge snacking as I'm preparing to go into whatever battle is awaiting me at 2 p.m. And then I go in, she gestures for me to sit down at 2 o'clock and says to me, I'm going to be out of the office tomorrow. And I wanted to let you know that yours is the name I'm putting on my out of office responder. And that was it, right? Like that was the bulk of what we were talking about. I'm sure we talked about other things in that meeting. I don't remember any of them, but imagine if she had been trying to communicate a change to me, even something that she thought was objectively good. I'm in no way prepared to hear that information because of how it was all set up. The concept at the core of this is one called priming, that something that happens before a decision really impacts someone's behavior. And so if she, it's easy to say, I came to learn there was a meeting on Thursday mornings that it made it more likely I was going to get emails like this. But I was always wondering, you know, is this the time? Did I actually do something wrong? It really impacted my ability to do great work, I would say, whereas maybe she saved 2 minutes writing that email. But I've lost hours of productive time by thinking and dwelling and considering this. If her email had said, I'm going to be out of the office tomorrow, do you have some time at 2 o'clock to discuss it? Totally different experience, right? So hours more of productivity, a better working relationship. I'm more likely to want to buy in on something when we have that meeting. If there is some new idea or a change coming, there's just a lot that comes from a little bit of thoughtfulness.
We could have a whole podcast episode unpacking that one email because I would have been stricken with paranoia for 3.5 hours that I was going to be fired that afternoon.
Yeah.
Let's talk about pricing. For those who are listening today and aren't on video, there's an interesting tchotchke behind Melina's head that looks to me something like a gold octopus. In fact, that is an icon that you purchase that you write about in the opening of this most recent book, The Truth About Pricing. Talk about why the heck you bought a gold octopus.
Yes, and why the first chapter of The Truth About Pricing is in fact called The Golden Octopus, which is a tactic in building curiosity and getting someone interested that they want to continue to read and, you know, pick that thing off the shelf, right? But in this case, the Golden Octopus is something that I had, you know, seen at a store for a long time, and I always loved it. It's beautiful. Octopus is my favorite animal, and I just loved it. I never really thought about buying it, but then we were moving out of the city and kind of saying goodbye to the old neighborhood, my husband and I. And eventually, you know, we went into that favorite home goods store that we would always frequent on walks that we used to take. And he encouraged me, nudged me to go ahead and buy it, you know, saying I was on the brink. We were moving to a new place. I was going to be starting consulting full time. And he said, hey, you should just buy it. It'll be this like symbol of like remembering what was and what's to come in our, you know, your new life in this space. As I was also starting to study behavioral economics more at the time, too. And so I bought it, you know, and I love it. And I have it here on the shelf behind me. It's one of the few things that I still have. We're not quite minimalists around here, which, you know, for those on video, again, my shelf has lots of things on it, but trying to be more in that like essentialism space. And it's one of the few things that I have. And I don't remember how much I paid for it, right? I don't have that memory of what it was. Even when I racked my brain, I'm not sure. I think it's somewhere, you know, $35, maybe $50. So it's obviously not real gold, this octopus. But it doesn't matter because I wouldn't sell it. You know, if someone offered me $50 for it, I wouldn't sell it to them. If they offered me $100, I don't think that I would sell it, or $250, right? And it gets a little bit ridiculous. Like, how? Why wouldn't you sell it? It's a thing you could probably get something just like it if you wanted. You could replace it with the same thing. But it's become a big piece of my identity. I've bonded with this thing. What would I be saying about myself, the dream, the journey, if I gave it up for some cash, right? So when we think about this, it doesn't make sense on a logical level. And understanding what motivates a purchase and why pricing isn't about the price. It's not about the number on the tag, but all the things that happen before the price matter more than the price itself. And then this book, The Truth About Pricing, is talking about all those aspects of psychology, all the things to consider that matter before the price, so that by the time it gets to someone seeing the price, it really becomes a non-issue for them almost. It's just so excited to move forward and get whatever that item is, like my golden octopus.
Melina, in your book, you open with a story about chocolate chip cookies, and you actually come back to it several times, kind of, you know, pulling on some of the lessons. Will you retell that story? Don't truncate it, and let people kind of unpack some or extrapolate maybe some examples in their own businesses from some of the teaching moments that you're going to talk about in this chocolate chip story.
Absolutely. So the framework I use for pricing and change are the same. It's called It's Not About the Cookie. So I want you to imagine we're walking down the street. We're having a lovely conversation and we haven't seen each other in a while, really engrossed in that chat. And then at some point we start to smell, there's this amazing scent that comes wafting down the street ahead of us. And while we're still talking to each other, it is now guiding us. We're a little bit distracted, right? We're like cartoon characters with our noses dragging us down the street, right? So we're trying to find the source of this scent. And eventually we see that it's a bakery. It's like, it's sweet and it's got a hint of chocolate and sea salt. And we realize it's these chocolate chip cookies that are baking. And then we see there's a line in front of the store. We find ourselves in the line. And then when we get there, they say, oh, today, you know, we have free samples and it's buy three, get one free for today only. You know, before we know it, we're walking out of the store, each eating a cookie and with a bag that has an undisclosed number in it for us, you know, down the road that we're going to be eating, right? So that's story one. Now we're going to go back, rewind. We're on the same street, same conversation. And this time someone comes up, shoves a coupon in our face and says, hey, today only, we've got these cookies for sale. And if you buy four, you only have to pay for three of them. I've got samples. Ugh. This guy, right? Like, didn't he see what a good conversation we were having? How rude is he? Now we're talking about, you know, bad sales experiences and one-upping conversations as we're talking about this experience. We get in front of the store, we see the line, and we're pitying those people that have worse standards than us. And by the time we finally smell the cookies, it's like that last thing that nudges us over the edge and say, I'm going to write a Yelp review about their bad sales practices and how I would never buy from them. What we want to know and realize here is that it could have been exactly the same cookies in both scenarios, right? In the first one, we're almost definitely buying. In the second one, we're almost definitely not. So it's not about the cookie, right? It's also not about the price. In the first case, they could have been $3 a piece. Maybe they were 25 cents in the second. That wasn't really a factor in whether or not we were buying. And what's really interesting is that all the same things happened in the two stories, but they happened in a slightly different way. And one of the key pieces, it's that priming I was talking about a minute ago, that scent of the cookies needs to pull you in early. And that's to attract that subconscious brain that's making most of the decisions, getting excited. It's going to be focusing our attention to say, look at this, we want this, we're excited about this. Where's that delicious scent coming from? And it doesn't just come from the scent of cookies, right? So no worries for those who are in, you know, sales-oriented businesses or you're all online or something like that. But we also had a way in that we framed the sale, right? So by saying buy three, get one free versus if you buy four cookies, you only have to pay for three of them. When things are said more clearly, when they rhyme, we believe them to be more truthful, more honest, and we believe in the person that's selling to us. Also, we talked, there's a little bit of scarcity with that today only. We had some herding behavior with the line, with the reviews that are out there because we're a herding species. So there are a lot of little acts in there that matter. And the book really breaks down everything that comes before. And then again, this framework of it's not about the cookie in how you implement. And in The Truth About Pricing, of course, it's about products and services out to customers in what your employees need and can't tell you. As I said, it uses that same framework, but it's in talking about how when you're presenting a change, all the same things really apply and you just use them in a slightly different way.
Lena, I want people to buy this book because there's so many great stories and examples of how to apply it in so many different circumstances, services, products, consulting, and such. I kind of want to turn the mic over to you for a few minutes and just have you teach us what are some of the common pricing mistakes or successes that people make, right or wrong, that today's listener and viewer can just be thinking about, okay, so does it really matter if my price is $4.99 or $4.98? Does it matter if I, you know, say buy one, get two free versus get two free if you buy what? Just take that wherever you'd like to go. There are a couple of surface things that might get people thinking about what they're doing right or wrong on their own pricing.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. And so I'll first address the number thing, because this is a question I get all the time, right? Is it a, you know, should I have my prices in a 5, a 7, or 9, or a 0, right? And how do I know? I'm feeling like this is the one decision that is the most important thing. In the book, another thing I'm going to touch on is how we kind of get in our own way when it comes to pricing. But to address this one item of the number, in general, it doesn't matter nowhere near as much as we feel like it does for that exact number. But if you are going to choose, there's a differentiation to knowing what type of business you are. I spend a lot of time in the book talking about deciding not, are we selling products or services? Are we in person or virtual? Things like that. But instead to say, are you a business that's built on quality or one that is built on value? And that fundamental decision is one of the most defining ones in the book and when it comes to thinking about your pricing. So a quality-based business, these are, yes, your luxury brands. It's if you're selling to celebrities, high-end, you want to be seen for your expertise. You are one that you have special accreditations or you're extra sustainable, investing in research and development. That quality side has a whole different vibe and way that we apply those concepts, like in the It's Not About the Cookie framework, to that model. So in the book, I give an example of Supreme, the brand that is, you know, based in clothing, but they've gone into so many different areas now. And when they have their logo on something, people get really excited and want to buy it. Even, you know, like a Pyrex measuring cup they did a collab with, which the regular measuring cup costs $5 essentially, and theirs was $25, and the only difference is a small logo that says Supreme on it, but it sold out almost immediately because of the way they leveraged scarcity, and then it goes on the resale market for a couple $100 of people wanting to buy this very simple measuring cup that functionally you could get the exact same one for only $5. But it's what it says about our identity, and people want to invest in that, you know, the quality of that kind of a brand. It feels different. And so the other side being a value, right? So this is the Costco, the Walmart, both aspects of a business are very, they're really good strategies, amazing businesses on both sides. So again, like Costco, Walmart. And if you go on those value sides where you're looking for a deal for people, it's a discount, the bargain. This is the type of brand where rounding down your price is going to really say something, right? $4.99 feels very different than $500. And knowing that when it comes to your pricing, so do you want to be on value or do you want to be a brand of quality? Is a key decision to then determine if you typically do whole number pricing or you're typically going to round down. If you're on the side that you're going to be rounding down, then whether you want nines or eights or fives, it typically doesn't make a difference. You can pick whichever one works for you, you feel good about, and move forward with that. But there are also, again, you know, different decisions here that way we tweak or implement is different when we're on one side or the other. And I know everyone who's listening, you're thinking, but I want both. I want to be quality and value. And this, herein lies the problem. When we live in that gray, it becomes a big cognitive weight for people. It's hard to classify you because it feels a little bit confusing. And they're not going to say, well, you know, you're talking about your a brand of quality, but then I'm seeing these value-based pricing models that feels a little bit different in the way that you're discounting or something. No one's going to say that. They're just going to say they need to think about it. They want to go evaluate a little bit more in a way that they shouldn't necessarily need that additional time. And so really owning and having everything your brand stands for be something of quality. Like I mentioned Costco on the value side, right? So they are a warehouse and it feels like a warehouse. You know they're not investing in expensive furnishings. You know that they're not investing in expensive ads, right? They are putting everything they can into value for their members. And they have things like $1.50 hot dog combos and the $4.99 rotisserie chickens that will never go up in price, even though they lose tens of millions of dollars on this every single year. It's because they care about their members and they're willing to be in it with you to get that good deal. But don't worry, Costco makes plenty of money, right? On the quality side, you know, you're going to go to Tiffany to buy an engagement ring and they have, you know, special champagne that they're giving you and this little cakes that you're able to get for free. It's a plush chairs and their website is so beautiful and all these things that's investing in that experience in a different way that goes all the way through everything that the brand does. So understanding what type of business you are and owning one, picking one, committing to it. If you learn nothing else or remember nothing else from this podcast and the conversation, doing that and doing everything you can to be all in and not get pulled into the other one. Like on the quality side, you probably shouldn't run a bunch of discounts and sales, even when everyone else is doing it something at the holidays or something, right? So being able to have those differentiated choices is really important. And as I said, as far as a thing that people get wrong, most of the time when it comes to pricing beyond this is people just really hate pricing in general, especially in smaller businesses and service-based businesses. When you're having to price your own time, it feels really stressful and our brains do a weird flip and cause us to focus on the wrong stuff. We spend a whole bunch of time doing what's called bike shedding, but really dwelling on something not very important. It's productively procrastinating on something small, like the exact number at the end of the price, and not really focusing on investing in all the things that really do matter, that can move the needle, these psychological impacts that you can be focused on that are going to have a bigger bang for your buck at the end. Where if you waste enough time in that productive procrastination, the things that kind of feel important, you're putting it off forever, though, to really make those decisions. One day you wake up and your launch is in 3 days and you haven't finished the price yet. And so you just pick something out of thin air and say, okay, we'll just go a dollar less than everybody else and we'll deal with this again in 6 months when we have more time. But you'll never have more time because your brain wants to keep putting this off. So knowing what matters, getting out of your own way, knowing that often you're going to dwell on the wrong things if you don't have a guide to help you know what to focus on. That's what I tried to put into the book in the same way where we help our clients to do this when it comes to pricing, being able to know what matters, make the right decisions, and to be able to move forward confidently so you can talk about those sales in a way that someone is going to feel you're exuding that confidence that makes it easier to buy from you.
Melina, thank you for that. I was riveted listening to you. I've always been fascinated with how things are priced. I know that when I buy a tennis racket, it's going to be somewhere between, you know, $85 and $210. And a pair of athletic shoes are going to be somewhere between $85 and $150. Or, you know, golf balls are X, right? I know what a rotisserie chicken costs, generally speaking. And then you go into Louis Vuitton or Gucci or Hermes or Dior or whatever it is, and you see a purse for, you know, $1,865 or $2,400 or $3,915 or $6,400. And I always kind of, my wife has a couple of these purses, shame on me. And I've always kind of wondered, I mean, I know what that cow costs and I know how much they are paying that artisan stitchery in, you know, Italy per hour. And I, you know, I can generally cost of goods it up to about, you know, $400 a purse. But I'm also wondering, like, how much is the brand equity worth in that purse? Is it really worth $4,000? Is it worth $9,000. When you get into the luxury goods market, which everybody has some level of that, whether that's your car, it's your wallet, it's your scarf, how do these higher level products, where we know the cost of goods is, you know, minimal, how does, and I don't want to pick on one brand, but how does Gucci decide that purse is worth $8,465 versus $7,248? Where does that psychology come about?
Yeah, it's hard to, obviously each one has its own specific model as to how they're going to pick their specific and exact price. But in that, you know, you gave the example of saying something is $8,015, right? That roundup is also really impactful of what it says about something versus if it was, you know, $7,985. You know, the $15 up is not the same as $15 down or a penny one way or the other, right? So that's important on some of the psychology. In the book, I talk about this in terms of grilled cheese sandwiches, and this is one of my favorite examples in there. So hopefully you can humor me a little bit here, but it really applies. In this case, when we think about a grilled cheese sandwich, you know, even people that can't cook, this is probably something that you could sit down and make yourself, right? There's not too much fancy going into the grilled cheese. And if you were going to buy those ingredients, you know, be a dollar maybe to make your own grilled cheese at home. And so I want the audience now, you know, take a moment, you're listening here. Think about if you really needed a grilled cheese, like you want one, you're going to buy, you're going to invest in what feels like a fancy grilled cheese. You're like excited. You see one on the menu. How much are you willing to pay for that grilled cheese sandwich? When I ask this question, often, you know, I'll hear people say, oh, I mean, 10, 15, 20. Sometimes I hear 25. I've even heard, you know, $35 before when we're talking about the grilled cheese. You know, sometimes they'll ask, does it have tomato soup with it or whatnot, right? But it's somewhere in that range. I think 35 is the highest I've heard someone say back. Now, there is a restaurant in New York City. It's called Serendipity 3. They have a grilled cheese sandwich that they sell. It's on their menu for $214. For a grilled cheese sandwich, yes, it does have a side of, you know, a tomato type of soup. And they sell it. People buy this. Serendipity 3 also has a $1,000 vanilla sundae, and they have $200 French fries that they sell. It's not all that they sell. They have other things that they have available on the menu, but people are going to buy these. When they introduced the $200 fries, which was something they did coming out of the pandemic to celebrate that they were still open or that they were reopening, they had a wait list of 8 to 10 weeks of people wanting to get $200 French fries, which is just mind-boggling when we think about it, right? Because, you know, how fancy can they really be? But also, I know when I tell this story, people go, well, I kind of want to try it. Like, what's going on with this grilled cheese sandwich? Why are these fries so expensive? You want to be in and part of that special experience. You have a wait list because they're scarce. Not everyone can get one. You have to order it in advance to be able to get them because the ingredients are so special and, you know, supreme and extreme and extravagant to get them. And even if you just go eat there, and you order something else on their menu, you may get one of those other sandwiches that's $45 because you're not going to go all the way in on a $200 grilled cheese sandwich, but you're part of it and you want to share about it on social media. But the thing is, that sandwich you bought is way more than what you would have otherwise because you're anchored in on the brand. What it says about you, you want to be part of the experience, in the know, you know, part of that in crowd. It all like wraps up in this vibe. That is says something different about those who buy from Serendipity 3. And then just to help again, when we think about the boxes we put ourselves into when it comes to pricing and wanting to get out of our own way, is while that has won a Guinness World Record as the most expensive sandwich at $215, it's actually not the most anyone has ever paid for one. If we remember the Virgin Mary grilled cheese, which went on eBay, it was a 10-year-old sandwich that a woman, you know, took a bite, saw the Virgin Mary in it, put it on her nightstand with cotton balls, and it didn't get a speck of mold for 10 years and then decided to sell it. And it sold for $28,000 or $38,000 on eBay. And it had 38 bids, I think, to be able to buy this sandwich. And so not everyone's going to buy that. Not everyone's that customer, but someone is. And you only need one person to buy the, you know, $30,000 sandwich. You don't need everyone to buy the $214 sandwich. And the point is, whatever you think is the max of what people would be willing to pay, whatever you think is that upper limit, it's probably not true. And so getting out of our own way and seeing what opportunity exists, taking that step back, is really important when it comes to understanding what our brand can be about and how we can create this really amazing experience that becomes a cool virtuous cycle for anybody. And it's not just for raising prices, right? Because I said about Costco, we can do this in a way that's talking about member value and things that we maybe are looking for ways to lower our prices, but still have this amazing experience or whatever that happens to be for people. So knowing that you want to own whatever you're about and that whatever you think the limit is of the model of how you can sell or how people are willing to buy in your industry or anything like that, or what they're willing to pay, doesn't have to be true if you don't want it to be.
In fact, one of the insights, many insights I took from the truth about pricing was that sometimes we'll have clients or customers that are pushing back on our pricing, and it may simply be they're not our customer. They aren't the right customer, and we should be thoughtful about, you know, maybe inoculating ourselves against their pushback and say, gosh, they're not my ideal customer, so I'm really not going to entertain or allow their pushback to make me second guess my pricing. Give us a minute on that, and we'll let you go.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Definitely not everyone is your customer, and that's okay. And knowing who you are for and what it's a fit for and being able to frame it in a way that someone can immediately see that it's not for them is ideal. But if you have the confidence that you know it's the right price, the value's there for the right person that you're a fit for, that if someone says, well, why would you charge that much? That's not expensive. That's too expensive. You can say, oh, no problem. You know, it's not a fit for you. Thanks so much. I know someone else you could work with or whatnot. Having that ownership, that belief in what you're worth and the value and what someone should pay for this and how that works, knowing other people do, is a huge piece in helping people to feel comfortable to buy when they are the right fit for you. And you can make sure you're investing in those people that are going to love to work with you and do business with you and like get it, right? That they love that experience. And for those who aren't, when you are willing to say, you know what, I can tell we're not going to be a fit for each other and this isn't the right mix for you. So we don't work with clients. We don't want you to invest money if it's not going to be a great win for you. So let's go our separate ways and we know someone you could work with. That's something that's got a lot of integrity that people respect when it comes to a company. And so there's a lot of value in that as well.
Melina Palmer, you are the host of the Brainy Business Podcast. You are a behavioral economist, and your most recent book is titled The Truth About Pricing, How to Apply Behavioral Economics So Customers Buy. Melina, thank you for investing in us. First of all, you're a great storyteller. And second of all, you know your stuff. And so I think many of our listeners and viewers today will go out and are already buying this book because there's so many great examples on how to apply these concepts, whether you own an Etsy store, whether you are eBaying, you're having a garage sale, you have a consulting service where you're selling, you know, your expertise. Fantastic series. What's next for you? There's got to be, you need a book that's red or yellow. So what's next for you?
Or purple, right? My brand has a lot of purple in it. I'm actually delighted right now. I'm preparing to do my first TEDx at TEDx Portland, which is going to be talking a bit about kind of how we get stuck on things and how to get out of our own way when we want to be more productive or implement what we learned in the great book and the amazing podcast, some quick tips, which I talk about in all of the books, but being able to have in a lovely 9-minute talk is going to be a lot of fun. So that is a big area of focus right now, is that TEDx. And we'll see if that turns into the purple, red, or yellow book.
How exciting. I have interviewed someone from the C-suite at TEDx, and I know how rigorous the preparation, well, the process of selection is, but also the preparation for that. So congrats to you. Delighted to have you back with the purple book in a year or two.
Sounds good. Thank you so much.
And we'll see you back here next week for a new conversation on leadership.